Sahanau bhunaktu saha viryam karavavahai tejasvinavatitamastu ma vidrishavahai. Om shanti shanti shantihi.
Okay, you ready? What is the purpose of the cosmic game? What is the difference between an enlightened being and an unenlightened being from the standpoint of the jagat? So why search for enlightenment? Well, the thing is, there is no difference in the self for an enlightened being or an unenlightened being or a mosquito or a fish or whatever, or a plant. There's only one self. But the self doesn't have any problems. It's non-dual. It is everything that is the most beloved for us, in fact. But it doesn't have sense organs or a mind. It's not subject to duality. And so from the standpoint of the self, there's no problem, and also really the only difference, therefore, between a light enlightened being and a non-enlightened being, somebody who has self-knowledge and who doesn't, is that the one has self-ignorance, and that self-ignorance causes this superimposition, this anyonya jasa, because the mind, being sattva, always reflects as though it reflects consciousness, and that lends to this mistake, this superimposition. It's anyonya, mutual superimposition, where the mind takes the self to be its self, and then it takes the self, therefore, to have all the qualities of the mind, or all the qualities of the body. So that's what makes an upadhi is that it takes the ahankara, the I notion. And if it takes the I notion, that means that this superimposition is taking place. And an upadhi means exactly that which lends itself to a mistaken identity. So I can take this body to be me because of the sukshma sharira, the subtle body, it endures in the sense of touch, it pervades the whole body, so the body endures consciousness. So I am the body, and so the body is me, and I have all the limitations of the body. That's the mutual superimposition. And so when one gains knowledge, the nature of yourself, it's not a different self. It's just because of that ignorance and remember that knowledge and ignorance and moksha and bondage, all of these things, those belong to the upadhi. It belongs really to the mind. It doesn't belong to the self. The self is non-dual. It doesn't have any parts. There is no problem at all. The suffering is from within the creation, from the standpoint of the jiva, because of self-ignorance. And that self-ignorance causes the mind to take myself the mind to take on the self, and therefore the self gains all the limitations. It should take on the self. I mean, I am itself, because I'm the Adhishtana. But that's not how it thinks about it. It thinks, I am the mind. And so therefore, because the mind is the conscious being, is me, therefore I have all of the gunas, all of the qualities of the mind. And so that needs to be resolved through all of these prakriyas that we use, you know, and through this, what we call viveka, this discriminating between two things that are appearing in the same place and time. So that actually solves the problem, because you discover that everything you really want to be, you are. There's no isolation between you and Bhagavan, between you and Ishvara. And this creation is really a manifestation of infinite knowledge, Maya, which has no independent being from me and is located as though in me, because there's nothing nowhere else to put it. There is nothing else. Right? When Maya is an unmanifest condition, then there is no time, there is no space. It's time and space come with the manifestation, just like if you have a dream or an imagination, all of the elements come along with that. But say if when that's, say, withdrawn, or even if it's not withdrawn, from the standpoint of the reality, from the self, there is no time and space or any kind of problem, you know. So the problem is only from the standpoint of the jiva that has self-ignorance, and so therefore has this mutual superimposition taking place that definitely limits you. You become subject to birth and death. You become subject to happiness and sorrow, you know, or old age, all of these things. You become subject to that. You become subject to so much loss and grief and unhappiness and all of these things because of ignorance, we're projecting all the ananda, the wholeness of myself, onto the world in the form of a desire. I want this. It's like saying, I want this. This will do it for me. This will make me happy. This will make me complete. And then you get it and you're happy for a little bit. And then that, even often, I used to realize this, I was happy for a little bit, but even while that happiness was there, another desire would come that would say something like, yeah, but you need this too. You know? Always searching to get this state of now all is well with me. I find over and over that doesn't work. So that's the suffering of the ajnani, the one who doesn't have self-ignorance, who has self-ignorance. But for the jnani, that self-ignorance is not there. You know? And so you're not dependent on the creation to make you happy or solve your problems. You are the ananda. And the creation itself is not separate from you. This jiva, the jiva upadhi, is part and parcel of the total upadhi, the Ishwara upadhi. Kind of like the wave is part and parcel of the ocean. You know, it's not separate. It is the ocean. It's just a part of, it's not the whole ocean, it's a part of the ocean. So it is the ocean. You know? And like that, everything about your upadhi is part of Ishwara. Is part of the body of Ishwara, you can say, the being, the manifestation of Ishwara, and the ananda that you're seeking is really the nature of the self from which this whole manifestation comes. So that solves the problem. Really. Of course, we have to we have to cure our wounds, and because. Those wounds and hurts are something that took place with kind of within samsara, and we have to be able to relieve ourselves of them because they cause so much pain. You know, it's not, the self-knowledge helps tremendously with that because it gives yourself is like a sanctuary, and it never changes. It's so strong, it doesn't succumb to anything. It's just always there, always whole, always complete. But the mind and the unconscious will still cause pain until those things are resolved because it exists within that order of reality. So we have to, in a sense, resolve it in that order of reality. You know, it's not just going to go away by itself just because you have knowledge. You know? I like we often use the put your hand in fire and it gets burned. But now that I have knowledge, it won't get burned. I don't think so. It will get burned. You shouldn't put your hand in fire. You should, if you want to do shoulds, like Ten Commandments shoulds, you know, mm-hmm. you need to be committed to Dharma, because that's who you are, actually, in terms of the upadhi, the body, all of the laws of the creation are an expression of Dharma, of an infinite order. And so when you go against that order, then you experience a rub, pain. And so, in fact, the whole creation is always kind of pushing us back on track. Because if we're not on track, there's pain. And that pain is the great teacher. You know? So you can actually, you know, in a sense, be grateful for your pain because it's raising its hand. You need to take care of something, you know. And then if you understand that, then your attitude towards it is different. Okay, I'll work on that one, you know, to resolve it, or do the inner child work, or do whatever is necessary to resolve it. Knowledge resolves a lot. Just knowledge. But it doesn't resolve everything. It resolves a lot because it makes the raga dvesha, your likes and dislikes, mitya. There is really no external happiness or fullness or wholeness. That's the very nature of the adhishtana. That's the very nature of the self. And we're looking in the opposite direction, trying to find it in this object and that object. So as you gain knowledge, the mind really settles down, you know, over time, because that viveka vairagya, that kind of dispassion born of viveka, that this object is not going to really make me happy. In fact, as you know, it doesn't have any ananda at all, you know. So my mind naturally starts to settle just because of my knowledge. But then we have unconscious wounds also, and we have to know how to work with that and be with that. We have to really be also become very cognizant of what is dharma and why it's so important in the way that in terms of the way we relate to others and relate to the universe. It becomes like the primary antikarana shuddhi is really a commitment to dharma over everything else. So it's dharma is Ishwara. Swamiji once said, you know, we say in karma yoga there's Ishwara Arpana Buddhi. Means I have a buddhi, I have a commitment to Ishwara, that everything I do is an arpana, it's a worship of Bhagavan. All of my actions are looked at as a puja. That's Ishwara Arpana Buddhi. And then when Swamiji was talking, he said, well, how does that, somebody asked him, how do you do that? And he said, you follow dharma. You become sensitive to dharma. Because that dharma is the, what we call sadharana dharma. It's shared by all beings. And that dharma is at the top, ahimsa, non-injury, or kindness, if you put it in a positive way. And under that, it's this very, very simple teaching, do unto others, the golden rule, do unto others as you would have done to yourself, and don't do to others as you wouldn't want done to yourself. That's worth meditating on, because it has so much richness. You know, we kind of take it for granted because it's been kind of a cliche, at least in the West, for so long. Everybody knows that. They all have it totally memorized. And so because of that, it's not usually really worked with to really understand the power of it. Because dharma is for us self-revealing in terms of how we want to be treated. It's not somebody else to teach you, really. When there's some really esoteric problem, and you seek a wise person of your time, it says in the Taittiriya Upanishad. Otherwise, dharma, in terms of how you would want to be treated in that situation, is pretty accessible, you know. But we don't, it's not as accessible if we're looking outward. But if you're thinking in the right way that you treat another person, or an animal or whatever, any being, you know, that how would I want to be treated? Then you know what to do. It's much more clear. And that's the order of the creation. That's your order. And say when you don't do that, there's a rub. You don't feel right. So Bhagavan kind of creates immediately that rub is the karmapala that you immediately get. And so that's also really useful, you know, because we don't want that karmapala. And it's not a happy thing. You want to feel love inside and wholeness inside. Yeah. I remember what Swamiji said. I think somebody asked Swamiji, how do you get to feel love inside? You know, like you feel your heart is filled with love. How does that happen? You know, and Swamiji said, well, you just have to love. To feel love, you have to love. That's all. That's all it is. But then to love someone, in terms of there's all different forms of love, but to love someone, you know, requires that we get rid of all our triggers that cause us to push our fears, that cause us to push people away, because they think, you think that, not you, I mean all of us, all beings, you think that that if I make room for that person, my life will become very unhappy, you know, because they'll take away from me the personality, or they're going to take away my shanti from me, and so I want to keep them at bay. But that doesn't work. They're in your prarabdha. And so you can try to keep them at bay and try to escape, but then your mind is suffering because of that pushing away and that protection. So then the mind isn't happy, even though you're keeping that person at bay. Because you're doing that, you don't have that fullness inside. So, yeah. No, there's no shortcuts. I think that's good. Let there be no shortcuts. Okay. What is the difference between vairagya and viveka? So in what we call the sadhana chatushtaya, chatushtaya means a group of four sadhanas. Those sadhanas, we're talking about really mental attitudes or mental understandings that actually are natural for a mamukshu. The sadhana chatushtaya, these four sadhanas, are what allow a person to be a mamukshu, or where that's the natural effect of these realizations. So the first one, it goes viveka, vairagya, and they're asking about this viveka, vairagya. Then there's the shamadhi shatka, the group of six qualifications like shama, dhamma, upadhiticca, diksha, shraddha, samadhi, dhamma, this group of six, and moksha, mumukshutvam. Those are the four. First two are really responsible for the mumukshutvam, the state of desire and liberation. So viveka is defined as nitya anitya vastu viveka. Viveka means the discrimination between two things. But here we're saying nitya anitya vastu viveka. I can discriminate in terms of this world that I experience. I have realized, I'll put it like this, I have realized that everything in the creation, everything within duality, including my body, mind, sense organs, my moods, my emotions, and every my desires, everything is time-bound. Time-bound means, nitya means timeless. Time-bound means anitya, it negates it. And so once a person really understands that, because everything is time-bound, and I become very clear about that once it dawns on you, then the hopes that you had, you become a whole, full being where I can say, you know, kritya krityaha, everything that is to be done in life is done. I am finished. I am full. I am complete. You realize that you can't achieve that in the creation. Not because you're incompetent or stupid, and not because the creation is mean. It's that the creation, by its very nature, is subject to change. And so any state of experience that you have is temporal. And there's no exception to that. And so whether it be an emotion or your health or your raga, your desire or your dvesha even, they're all temporal. They can even all turn into their opposite. You know, and so when you realize this is just law of the creation, you can no longer ask it to give you moksha. It can't, because there's nothing but change there. It's a continually temporal. It can give you what you can call, well, it gives me a little bit of moksha, you know, lasts for a short period of time, but when I have that short period of, in that short period of time, I can be really, really happy. You know, but then down you go, because whether it's, you know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 1 year, it's still temporal. It still comes to an end. And so there's nothing, no place to rest in this creation. Right now I can say, oh, everything's fine. Because even your own upadis are continually changing. So now you've recognized that. And so now you can't bring yourself really to pretend like you don't know that. And so the vairagya, that vairagya means dispassion, but dispassion is not like this. Dispassion is that I know that this can't, these things can't fulfill me or give me really what I'm looking for. And so they don't carry the same urgency or the same level of desire, you know, that they did before I realized that. And so that's why we say it's dispassion. So viveka leads to vairagya. And the vairagya is just the realization that of the heaven worlds I may have wanted to go to, the different lokas in next lives I may have wanted to go to, or things, desires here in this loka that I'm experiencing. Loka means world, in this world that I'm experiencing. I thought if I could just get those things, I would be happy. That doesn't hold water anymore. That's not true. And so, in a way, that's kind of like the dark night of the soul, you know, because it's not like there's a loophole somewhere. You know, there's no loophole. So then you throw your hands up. I remember this happening to me, but it's also said in the different prakarana grantas. It's like you throw your hands up to Bhagavan and say, you know, please save me. There must be something to know, something. There must be something. I can't believe that there's no solution to this, what Swamiji will call this fundamental desire to be whole and complete, to be free. I can't believe it's not there, but I know this universe can't give it to me. So please help me, in whatever form you say that. So. The jnani, knowing that the hungry tiger is himself, in essence, still runs away. Why? There's a good story about that. There's an Advaita Vedantin, you know, and a Dvaitin. A Dvaitin means a dualist. And they're in Rishikesh, according to Swamiji's story. They're in Rishikesh, and they're having a big debate. Between the non-dualists, the Advaitins, and the dualists, you know. And as they're in the middle of their debate, and they all have, each have their own sides, have come to watch and experience it. And the debates, just by the way, are serious undertakings, you know, because the person really has that position and takes that position seriously. And also is very aware of the other person's position. And so the debate is really a debate for depth and for understanding. And in fact, the loser converts to the other side, in, as the story goes, in probably old India. You know, because they're all after, and all of the different darshanas in India, they're all after the truth. And the truth is moksha. In almost all of the darshanas, knowledge, self-knowledge is moksha. Or knowledge of the nature of reality is moksha. And the prompt suffering, bondage, is caused by self-ignorance. So that's not just Vedanta, that's common in the different darshanas. But if knowledge is liberation, not that you gain knowledge and then go do something, the knowledge is the recognition of the wholeness of yourself, or the nature of reality and how to be in that reality from a more Buddhist perspective. And so, here they are surrounded by their disciples, and this debate is going to take place, and it's a serious thing. It's taken seriously, so because the final quest is really for knowledge of the nature of reality. So they're in the middle of their debate, and a tiger comes into the arena where they're all sitting outside, which is very usually, they have these big tents and things, and they all sit under the tent to be out of the sun. And this debate carries on, but it's all open, completely open. So this tiger comes wandering in. And so everybody including the Advaitin, who's the person who's representing Advaita in this debate, jumps up, runs over to a tree and climbs up the tree. And of course the Advaitin jumps up and, you know, runs over to another tree and climbs up the tree. You know? And so does everybody else is scrambling also. You know? So then here's the Advaitin way up on the top of the tree and they're all watching the tiger waiting for him to go. And the Advaitin says, if there's only Advaita non-duality, how is it that you run up the tree? What are you afraid of? Why did you run up the tree? Yeah. And he says, the Advaitin says, I ran up the tree to save myself. What do you mean? You're free of time and space. There's no problem for you. No, there's no problem for me at all. Then why did you run up the tree? Well, because this mithya body ran up the mithya tree because of the mithya tiger. There's no problem for me, but why would the mithya body not run away from the mithya tiger and save yourself by running up the mithya tree? Why wouldn't you do that? That would be kind of abnormal. It's natural to all of your instincts and everything go toward living, not dying. So I just explained a little bit, and that's the story. And this is probably maybe in remembrance of that story. It's not like you gain knowledge and you become somebody who's not living within Vyavahara. It's just that you know what Vyavahara means, this empirical reality. In fact, you're living in empirical reality as a normal person. Which is another interesting, just a normal person, normal you. So what would be the difference between you as you are, as a jnani, and as an ajnani? What is the difference, really? You still look the same, you still have the same past, you know, you still have the same talents and phobos, and all of those things are still there. But if you've been allowed to mature in your knowledge, these raga dveshas become mithya. The likes and dislikes become mithya, means non-binding desires. Because you know yourself. And so that gives the mind, you know where the source of ananda is. And the source of ananda is not away from the mind. It's your very nature. And so the mind relaxes. Also, you know that this body is part and parcel of Ishvara. And Ishvara is not away from yourself. And so you can relax and let Ishvara be Ishvara. And you have that Ishvara Arpana Buddhi and happily do what is to be done. You can just be in your life, which I think is really wonderful. You can be in your life and live your life and enjoy your life. Because it's your life. It's your prarabdha. Nobody's going to take that away from you. So I Swamiji said, you know, if it's in your prarabdha to have that, you will have it. And if it's not, then you won't. So nothing to worry about. But why really? Yeah, but I worry about it, Swamiji. Okay. Why though? Well, because I haven't had a chance yet to really assimilate the real source of ananda. It takes some time because we have infinite lifetimes, beginning those lifetimes doing everything in the opposite way. So it takes time for the mind to come into harmony with your knowledge, because there's just so many different types of experiences that are held there in the unconscious. We call it, like Swamiji calls it, I think he's the one that came up with this actually, he says there's an emotional lag time. Yeah. But it's like you gain this knowledge and it's like being reborn in a way. Now this upadhi has a whole different orientation in terms of the way that you are with the world. You know, it's not that you you change, you might keep your same job and you've got your same friends or whatever. It's not that. It's that you can be with the world as it is without depending on it to make you happy, because you've discovered the source of happiness as your own being. And so it's not like, well, now that I have knowledge, I guess I don't need to be happy. No, it's now that I have knowledge, I am happy, and nothing will ever take that away from me. So that gives me the freedom to just be a jiva upadhi that belongs to Ishwara and do what's here to be done. And this is all free. You have this. Your prarabdha karma, you don't have to work for it. The prarabdha karma you already have, you know. And so you can live out that prarabdha karma, and as a mumukshu, you use your karma to grow, because we still have all kinds of projections and everything until they all drop off. But you can kind of enjoy that process, you know, that process of the being patient and kind of enjoy, like, the opening of the rosebud. And it opens very slowly, but it never stops opening. You know, that's the thing. So you can be with that. You can be here. You can really cherish the people that are in your life. You know, because you have them, because they are in your life. That's a huge thing. You know, they're in your life. If they like it or not, they're there. They're in your life. You don't have to go out looking for other people. You have plenty of people. And other people will come and go in your life, and there they are. Many things to be done, those will come into your life, and there it is. You don't have to worry about it. So, that's all. Each little question becomes a lecture. I have to learn how to answer these a little bit better. Okay. Could you please talk about the inner critic again? When is it born? You said it could take the place of the buddhi. Okay. It is also part of the manas. How do you recommend that I talk to it? It feels so integrated with my inner voice, so it so easily becomes the one steering and guiding me, and feels hard to separate. I can feel how it tenses me up by all the integrated critic. Yeah. What's so interesting about this is that usually this inner critic is formed when you're very, very young, maybe way before 7. It's what we call internalized. It's like an introject. It's an internalized mother or father or grandparent or whoever was really taking care of you. And say they happen to be always critical of you, always have something... Never, you know, proud of you, really, just always criticizing it. You could have done better, you could have done this. And so the little child internalizes that and from a very young age talks to herself like that. You didn't do well enough. You could have done much better, you know. That drawing could be really, really much better than it was. You're not a very good artist. On and on and on and on. Depending upon the way that your parents or whoever was taking care of you, treated you, you know. So if you had critical parents, then you internalize that, and you have this critical voice going on all of the time, you know, blabbering away. And then the funny thing is that you don't even notice it, that you have an inner critic, because it's always there. It's kind of like just background noise. But for one, in psychology, you know, in therapy, one thing we do with our clients is have them pay attention, and of course we do it here also, pay attention to see how you talk to yourself. And then they'll write it down and take notes on it and just start to be really alert. Because having an inner critic inside is really worse than having a critic outside. Because if it's inside, you're carrying around that around with you all of the time, you know? And so you don't have shanti inside, because nobody likes to be criticized. If there's a critic outside, that is always complaining about you, or you haven't done this well, or that, you can escape, you know, and go away. But that can, that inner critic can make your inner environment, your inner home. And so when people start to really pay attention to how those inner voices are talking, then something can be done about it. Like you can say to the critic, I know why you're talking like this to yourself, because that's how you were always talked to. But we don't have to do that anymore. We don't have to do it. You know, those your parents aren't doing that anymore. I'm not going to do that. You know, so let's be positive. And the mind will kind of go, or however you have to say in your own language, but the mind will kind of go, what? Really? And start getting almost immediately tremendous relief. Because it doesn't even want to be an inner critic at all. It's just, what do you call it, habitual, unconscious absorption of being treated in that way. Yeah. Like, on a more positive note, what if your parents gave you, as a child, a lot of positive regard for just being you? Not for any reason other than you exist. And so they love you and they're proud of you and they think you're wonderful. Not because you do anything at all. Just because you are. Which is kind of normal, actually. And so, but when that's there, then the child internalizes that and doesn't have feelings of lack of self-worth or lack of being loved or lack of being wanted. It always feels loved. It doesn't even know what it would mean not to feel. It doesn't even know it always feels loved, because it's just what the inner environment that it has. And it doesn't have anything to compare it to. And then say the parents, when you do a drawing for, you know, some drawing, or you make something, some clay figurine or some plaything that you do, they're always very interested, you know, in what you've done. That's so much nicer than say, oh, here, let me help you. We can do that better. You know? Mm-hmm. But what if they just love what you have done and are interested in it, and let them tell you about it and how you made it and all of that, and tell them it's really nice. You know? Or they bring home their pictures that they did at school, and you sit and love the picture and you put it on the wall. And, you know, that's normal. That's normal, but people are burnt out and tired and exhausted, and they've been abused themselves when they were young, and so they can't give that type of unconditional regard to their children. They're passing on what they themselves got, you know. Some people treat their children like that, passing on the way they were treated, and then this one type of person, probably more wounded. Than another type of person who tries to give their children everything they didn't get, you know. So they realize what would that have been like, you know. And they want to fill their children up with all of the things that they wish they would have gotten. And I think that's healthy and normal. So let's read this question again. Okay, so again, when does the inner critic born? Probably at a very, very young age. As soon as a child starts to cognize, and as soon as they're young and the parents or caregivers are very critical, then that's what's going inside. You know? It becomes structural, actually. And so normal, you don't even notice it. You don't know what it would be like not to have that, you know, it's just part of being alive until you point it out. That critical voice is something that comes up into up from the unconscious, really, and I would say overwhelms the buddhi, you know, because the buddhi, it's like a Freudian superego. It's commenting. As a voice in the buddhi. You could put it in the manas, I suppose. It will all go in the manas once the buddhi starts coming into relationship with it and say, you don't have to do that anymore. But until that happens, even if it's located there in the unconscious and it rises up, you can say it rises up in the manas or whatever, but it overwhelms the buddhi. You know, it's there chattering away there. Once the buddhi is able to recognize it and split off from it, then that inner critic or whatever the voices are can really be changed without, it's not that hard. Especially if you explain, you know, why they're like that, and they don't have to have that job anymore. You know. It's nice. And then you start having a beautiful home inside that you love to be. You just love to be home with yourself because you have an inner friend, not an inner critic.
And some education in that. And I just want to, if you also notice that it can be hard to let go of this inner critic, just because there can be a sense of that if I'm not critical anymore, I'm going to become lazy, or I'm not going to perform, or, you know, that it has, many people think that it has that function.
They do.
That it can be hard.
And they're afraid.
Yeah, afraid of it.
They're afraid to let it go because it's like a taskmaster.
Mm.
You know, it's kind of whipping you into place. But it actually is not true.
No.
But that's the fear. So sometimes you have to be kind of brave.
Yeah.
And you have to stand up for yourself. Say, I don't need to be whipped into fear to do things. You know, I do the things that I love to do, the things that I do, and I don't need a taskmaster to punish me or threaten me all the time. What awful, you know. Mm-hmm. So you have to have a little talk with with that fear. That's a common thing, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, if somebody's not, you know, at the whipping post, they won't perform as well. I don't believe in that. I'd rather not perform as well and have a nice person there. I think in a meditation some time ago, you first had us meditate on being Ishwara and then asked us to meditate on being Brahman. Now do we make the shift in meditation? How do we make the shift in meditation? Or maybe I misunderstood. When you're, say, it's just two different types of meditation, actually. It's not a shift that you have to make. It's just a different meditation that can, both can happen at the same sitting, you know. If you're meditating upon yourself as Ishwara, then you have your being, the Satchitatma, you know yourself. And then that self, from that standpoint of that self, you recognize your being as really the Adhishtana of the whole creation, that you have to imagine the whole creation, but you're imagining it as Ishwara, and the body, mind, sense organs, and everything about your upadis are part of Ishwara. They belong to Ishwara. And so now this body, mind, sense organs is given over to Ishwara, which is already Ishwara, but because of ajnanam, ignorance, we have to give it over. And then, then you, from there, you recognize that the whole Ishwara, which includes everything, including all of my upadis, right, has for its adhishtana the self, that there is only one self. So I sit with that visualization or meditation of myself as Ishwara, which means the body, mind, sense organs is given to Ishwara. So I recognize that this all belongs to Ishwara. Ishwara is part and parcel of Ishwara, is taken care of as Ishwara. And then I recognize Brahman, myself as Brahman, which is myself, non-dual Brahman. So it's not Brahman doesn't become big or small. It's non-dual. So I am non-dual. So I recognize my being as the very self of Ishwara. So then I'm recognizing, focusing, in a sense, on the adhishtana, on my being, on the I, on the aham, And then I'm another type of part of that meditation, if we do both together, then I recognize that this whole manifestation is my manifestation of this aham. There's only one aham. There's only one I. And then Ishvara. This is the Jiva Upadhi. The Ishvara Upadhi is the total Upadhi. But both Upadhis are mine. This Upadhi, body, mind, sense, organs, is part and parcel of Ishvara. But then from my standpoint, I have, from the standpoint of the Jiva, myself, the Pratyagatma, the innermost self, is the very self of Ishvara. There's only one self. So then I recognize that this body, mind, sense, organs belongs to Ishvara, and then this Ishvara Upadhi is my Upadhi from the standpoint of the self, not from the standpoint of the Jiva. From the standpoint of the Jiva, it's my Upadhi still, but from the standpoint of the Jiva, this body, mind, sense, organs is part of Ishvara, like a cell in the body or something like that. It's part of Ishvara. And so therefore, Ishvara, you know. And so, and then I see that that Ishvara is intimately me. So there's no distance between me and this creation. It's not somebody else's creation. This whole thing is only myself. So nobody's coming and intruding on you, you know, or taking control over things or something. Like there's me, the Jiva, and then there's that Ishvara over there. No, that Ishvara is me. It's my Maya. The Maya is rooted, whatever word to say, in the self. It belongs to the self. And I am that self. So I can recognize myself in terms of the infinite Ishvara Upadhi, or in terms of the Jiva Upadhi, which is part of the Ishvara Upadhi. So that way, both things are there. You can, depends on what direction you're looking. Maybe you want to just be with yourself, and then you can recognize Ishvara, kind of imaginally, or recognize Ishvara in the form of every vritti that's passing through. But you can also do the imagination. You can also do the, kind of the same thing with an Ishtadevata. The Ishtadevata is kind of like the mature you. It's your mentor, you know. But it's also what you're growing into. Just an expression of Ishvara without the Jiva Srishti, without the Ajnana. Just a beautiful expression of Ishvara. That's an Ishtadevata. Every Ishtadevata is different, like every Upadhi is different. But that every Upadhi is an expression of Ishvara, and then it gets muddled up because of Ajnana and because of self-ignorance. Right? And with that self-ignorance, all kinds of Jiva Srishti, hurts, unconscious stuff, and all these things that are born of ignorance start to muddy the waters a little bit. But as you kind of settle down into your knowledge, this body, mind, sense, organs is Ishvara. There's very little Jiva Srishti. As time goes on, the Jiva Srishti, the Jivas, means the Jivas creations, projections, and all of that, just become less and less and less over time, because you don't need them. They don't perform any function, because you are already whole and complete. You don't need desires. You don't get anything. That's just experience also. You don't get anything at all out of being mean to somebody or unkind or impatient. Zero. You just get negative things. And so you get lose interest, you know, in behaving in a negative way toward others, because the others will suffer, but you also suffer. That's the kind of the order. So you just learn slowly, slowly. It takes time for most of us. All right, I don't know about these. I think I'm done, but let me just see. Oh, this is from yesterday. These poor last two. You have to put these on the top. Okay. We have to do this tomorrow because I've run out of gas. There's nothing left. But we should put them on the top and I'll do this first tomorrow.
swasti prajapya paripalayantam nyayena margena mahim mahishah ko brahmane pyashubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukino pavantu kale varshatu parjanyah prithivi sasya shalini Desho yam shobharahitaha brahmana santu nirbhayaha om sarvesham swastir bhavatu sarvesham shantir bhavatu sarvesham purnam bhavatu sarvesham mangalam bhavatu Sarve bhavantu sukhinah, sarve santu niramayah, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kaschit dukha bhag bhavet, asato ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma amritangamaya, Om Purnamadav Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om